From the heartland of America and the gateway to the West, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie. Welcome to Coast AM. Later on tonight, oh yes, those open lines. And later on, investigative mythologist William Henry. Here's what's happening. Well, are we going to war with Iran? That's the big question tonight. The U.S. will deploy thousands of additional troops to the Middle East as tensions with Iran mount following the airstrike that killed one of their generals, supposed to be the second in command of the entire country. The additional troops will come from the immediate response force of the 82nd Airborne Division. Meanwhile, Iran has vowed to turn the day into night after President Donald Trump taunted the country after the bombing of the general, his name is Qassem Soleimani, sparking fears of World War III. Some people are really concerned about that. Mr. Trump said earlier that the slain general should have been taken out many years ago. He did that on Twitter. Former acting CIA director Mike Morrill predicted that General Qassem Soleimani's death would ultimately come at a high cost, expecting Iran to retaliate and kill American civilians as well. Let's check in with Dr. Jerome Corsi, author of Atomic Iran, for his take on all of this. Well, Jerry, what do you think, sir?
Well, I think, George, first of all, the violence is clearly picking up in with Iran right now, because President Trump is not going to tolerate the kinds of attacks that occurred on our embassy in Iraq, in Baghdad. And the killing of Soleimani, I think, was clearly in retaliation for that strike. And President Trump is going to resist Iran's incursions into Iraq. There's also Hezbollah sleeper cells in the United States, which I think are of concern.
Yes.
The ramping up of tensions in the Middle East, I've always said war is not the solution in the Middle East, it's the problem. And the wars, I think, will intensify the hatred, the cycle of hatred that continues in the Middle East. And while Iran continues to be the problem, I just don't think President Trump is going to tolerate the kinds of aggressive attacks we saw on our embassy in Iraq. And this is in retaliation. We are going to see more retaliation. And I think Iran is not going to be able to step up the violence without having President Trump take aggressive steps to stop Iran.
Has Russia or Putin said anything about this?
So far, I think everything's been pretty quiet. I think everybody's waiting to see what the next steps are. And if Iran takes aggressive retaliation, it will just simply ramp up the violence. And that's the next step. We have to wait to see what happens. What's the retaliation from Iran? How intensively does President Trump really want to ramp up war in the Middle East? Does he want another war going into an election cycle? I think that, you know, the problem is with Iran right now is being squeezed by the sanctions, and they're not simply going to sit quietly without trying to. We had a cycle of attacks on shipping in the Gulf, and now this is the next cycle of violence that Iran is trying to promote to get a relief of the sanctions. I don't think President Trump's going to relieve the sanctions, and I think we're headed towards more violence in the Middle East.
Now, is he going to need any act of Congress before he takes any further steps militarily?
I think there's enough sufficient congressional authority for what's been done so far. And going back even into the Obama administration, I think a lot of the actions that were taken aggressively do not require a new act of Congress. I don't think there's going to be a war at the moment. It's probably going to be a series of retaliations and strikes. But if the cycle ramps up tremendously, such that we're at war with Iran, then yes, Congress will have to be consulted.
Jerry, what's your latest website, sir?
As CorsiNation.com. Thank you.
Very good. Thank you. Dr. Jerome Corsi, our expert on such matters. Australia's Navy has rescued hundreds of people stranded on a Victoria beach as more than 200 wildfires continue to rip through the nation's eastern states, prompting the largest peacetime evacuation in the country's history. At least 19 people are dead, 28 more missing after hundreds of fires scorched more than 12.35 million acres of land, destroying at least 1,400 homes in three states and killing millions of animals out there in the forests as well. Well, they say it's documented at this point that modern employees are feeling more stressed than ever before. All of that work anxiety has prompted employers and companies to try out a variety of soothing activities for their employees, from morning meditation sessions to video games in the break room. Now, a new study identifies a charmingly simple solution. Researchers from a university in Japan say that small potted plants around the office can go a long way towards relieving employee stress. How about that one? I had a plant in my office in Los Angeles. Tommy forgot to water it while I was in St. Louis, and the thing died. LG is set to release a 65-inch rollable television, which unfurls itself from your ceiling. The ultra-high-definition wafer-thin screen is set to be unveiled at the Consumer Electronics Show in Las Vegas next week. How about that? And it's time for Peter Davenport and the National UFO Reporting Center's update on just what's going on in the skies. Hi, Peter.
What's going on, George? And I wish I had one of those potted plants to reduce a little stress on the hot.
We got to get you one.
Well, I've collected about 400 written reports over the last 2 weeks. And from among those are the following four, which are some of the best that I've seen in a long time. First one comes from an airline pilot, George. He starts off his report by saying, "I'm a 737 captain at a major U.S. airline. In 21 years of flying with an air carrier, I've never been seen something that I couldn't explain in one way or another. This event is my first exception." He goes on to write that on Saturday, the 21st of December, 4 days before Christmas, of course, he was pilot in command flying from New York to San Francisco, and he looked up ahead of his aircraft under subdued light. This is about almost 8 o'clock, 7:50 p.m. local time. He was about 50 or 100 miles north of Kansas City, Missouri. He looked out ahead of his aircraft, and he saw four what he thought were very peculiar stars that he had never noticed before. Well, he turned his light down. He was eating his crew meal at the time and continued to monitor them. And about 5 minutes into his sighting of these things, his first officer said she could see them as well and wondered what they were. They were very peculiar in appearance. Long story short is, they sat there for 25 minutes, the stars did, very unusual. At first, I thought they were talking about the Starlink satellites that Elon Musk launched on the 11th of November, but they were not. Suddenly, the center of five stars out ahead of the aircraft flared up quite brightly, and the two pairs of stars on either side of the center one just suddenly disappeared. We'll have that report posted on Tuesday of the upcoming week. Next report I'd like to share with our audience is equally intriguing. Comes from Jersey City, New Jersey. A woman writes that she and her 11-year-old son were walking into a pharmacy, and suddenly she developed a severe headache and a very metallic taste in her mouth. And she looked at her son, and by his gyrations, his expression on his face, she realized that he was experiencing something similar. Suddenly, the sky turned purple and pink above their heads. Her son suddenly started dragging her into the pharmacy and wanted to get out of the outer area of that parking lot. And he asked his mother if she had seen the gray triangular craft above their heads, just very close to the top of the building. Very interesting report, which, again, we'll have posted on Tuesday. Last two reports quickly are from tonight. One is from Grady, New Mexico. A woman, very responsible woman, saw a cluster of objects moving overhead. Again, possibly the Starlink satellites that were launched in November, but she insists they were not. I'm going to develop that case a little bit more, and we'll report back on a later date to the Coast audience what we find. Finally, a sighting from Tulsa, Oklahoma. A gentleman who used to serve in the 82nd Airborne says tonight he was outside with his wife, and they both saw a very bright plate-shaped object streaking overhead. So we'll have all of these posted and 390 more in the very near future.
George. Super, Peter. We'll talk to you next week. That's Peter Davenport from the National UFO Reporting Center. Up next, Jonathan Zapp back with us, author and mythologist, as we talk about his work with the afterlife and so much more next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you, along with Jonathan Zapp back with us. Jonathan is an author, philosopher, journalist, teacher who has written extensively on psychology and contemporary mythology. He's the author of The Zapp Oracle and is a featured correspondent and editor for Reality Sandwich, which is a very popular online magazine. Jonathan has an extensive background in Jungian philosophy and psychology, a paranormal researcher and dream interpreter. For more than 30 years, he's been using the tools of Jungian psychology to study popular culture and contemporary mythology. One of his books, Crossing the Event Horizon. Jonathan, welcome back. Happy New Year to you.
Happy New Year to you. It's great to be back.
Looking forward to this. And as we get into this, with the breaking story of this Iranian situation, you had a premonition, some kind of an event. Tell us what happened.
Well, what happened was yesterday afternoon, I walked out of my study after a long writing session. It was roughly 1:30 p.m. Mountain Time. And I'm just walking from my study through the living room into the kitchen. I glanced to my left. There was my godson. I have two godsons who live with me. And just like usual, he was there sitting at the dining room table like any American 15-year-old preoccupied with his screens and wearing bright green headphones.
Yeah, that's right.
And I actually created a page that's linked on your site that, you know, shows a picture of that and has some stuff related to what happened and also to the main topic for tonight. And so readers, listeners can check on that when they have time. But anyway, just as I was entering the kitchen, and usually, you know, when I exit my study, I'm still preoccupied with, you know, I'm an introvert and I'm still thinking about what I was writing about, but I had this kind of deja vu like fantasy that was so distinct where I imagined that I had just heard some shocking news about Iran and that I walked into the dining room and said rather dramatically to my godson Indigo, take off your headphones. You've got to hear about this. This is a world historical event. And then I explained to him what happened, except nothing had happened yet.
Mm-hmm.
As we knew in the news about the embassy, but that was a couple of days old already.
Right.
And then I asked him, and you know, I'm a former school teacher, and everyone in my nuclear family was an educator. So I kind of have a, you know, especially relating to, you know, youngsters like that, I tend to get into a kind of school teacher-like pose, which was very realistic in how I would present something like this to him. And I said, now tell me why you should be even more concerned about this than me. And he just looks at me kind of stumped. And then I explained that, you know, when I was about your age, there was still a draft going on. And 18-year-olds were being, you know, conscripted into the military to serve in Vietnam. And, you know, that you'll be in that age range in just 3 years. Anyway, then... of course, the shocking events happened. When they did, and I was first hearing about them on my Bluetooth headphones, I was in the kitchen.
Were you shocked?
Well, I was shocked. I didn't even, I'm not sure if I even made the connection yet, but he wasn't there, but he and his mother and brother came in through the front door. They'd been out grocery shopping. And then I had almost exactly word for word the very conversation that I had imagined earlier with him.
Jeez.
And in fact, without any prompting from me, he went and took the seat that I saw him in the fantasy. And then I posed the question, you know, why should you be even more concerned about this than me? He wasn't stumped. He said, well, because this is going to affect the future of the world for a long time to come. He didn't think about the drafting part. And then I word for word explained that part. And so it was a very strange moment. And, you know, one idea about premonitions and prophecies is that they are not necessarily foreseeing a predetermined future event, but that they may be sort of extrapolated projections based on probabilities. And so so that's why the actual event that transpired wasn't absolutely identical, because free will can have a wild card effect, and the decision to go grocery shopping meant that, you know, he was not sitting at that dining room table, which 70% of most evenings, he would be working on his homework or social media or whatever. So it was very eerie. And then, and I had a similar kind of premonitory event before 9/11, which I wrote about on that page, but a lot of people did about that event. And then later in the evening, I was watching the news with a friend of mine, and I was seeing pictures of Soleimani. And I was
that's the general that got blown up by the drone.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. And what struck me was how charismatic he looked. Now, don't get me wrong. This is a guy who deserved to be killed. Whether strategically that was the right move or not is a whole other question.
He was a terrorist.
Yeah, I mean, he was a completely bad guy, you know, who had, you know, had the blood of many Americans and many other people and his own people on his hands and so on and so forth. But anyway, I noticed that he looked almost like a Persian version of Sean Connery, and I found that very disturbing. Huh. And then last night I had a rather disturbing, slightly gruesome dream related to this. I won't describe that now, but it's on that page. But what it all stirred up was a feeling that in terms of the psychology, the collective unconscious and the psychology of Shia Muslim guys in the Middle East, is that this guy sort of represented a real idealized male, alpha male, kind of like ego ideal. You know, he's seen as courageous, physically charismatic. And so I think that this is an extremely dangerous thing, for the additional reasons that there's a kind of psychological complex where many males in the Islamic world, it's a very patriarchal and macho culture, have a kind of wounded male pride because, you know, in earlier stages of the history of Islam, and I'm also indebted to your friend Howard Bloom, whose excellent book, The Muhammad Code, penetrates into this more thoroughly than any other book I've read on the subject. But, you know, they were world-conquering dominant force, you know, so that by 110 years after the death of the prophet, they had conquered a landmass 7 times that of the United States.
Yeah, huge.
3 times the size of the Roman Empire. But in more recent history, there's been a lot of wounded pride there because Western civilization has completely outpaced them in military power and technological sophistication, and groups that they expected and that their mythology, and it's in the Quran, leads them to expect that they will predominate over infidels, women, every other group, and have a worldwide caliphate. And that was always part of the plan. And yet reality keeps sort of spitting in the eye of their idealized self-image of themselves as world-conquering heroes. And so here you have this guy, Suleiman, who is, you know, as if created by central casting to look like, you know, the ideal, physically charismatic, dominant male, you know, Islamic general.
And they say he was the heir apparent to the throne, basically, of Iran.
Right, right. He could have been the next president or supreme leader. He's been around longer than the current president. And so I see it as creating intense shockwaves to, you know, the sense of collective identity that's already in a fragile and, you know, wounded state.
We've got a minute to go before the break, Jonathan. Do you see this escalating? Are you intuitively feeling this is going to get bigger and bigger?
Well, I feel that that's the probability, because like when I was building security coordinator of a high school in the South Bronx and had to break up fights, I always tried to give, you know, a combatant a face-saving way out. So if I got between them, you could say later, well, I would have, you know, beaten him, but, you know, Zap got in the way. What I notice here is that there's no face-saving way out of this. Their pride is going to demand an extreme reaction. And then our president's pride will demand a counter-reaction, and that's just, how does that de-escalate?
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. Jonathan, stay with us. We're going to come back in a moment and talk more about your work with the Afterlife Communications. Jonathan's website, Zap Oracle, ZAP, oracle.com, linked up for you at coasttocoastam.com. And we will get into his afterlife communications work. Next hour, of course, we'll take phone calls right here on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you along with Jonathan Zapp. Jonathan, let's talk a little bit about the afterlife communications. And how did this start for you, and how did you get involved with this?
Well, my first experience was when I was 2.5 years old, and it had some evidential aspects, and they appeared to be elders from my ancestral Jewish lineage. Years later, I got the strong feeling that the leading voice was a grandmother, Augusta Zapp, who died during World War II. And then there were a few other experiences, mostly sort of one-off experiences, until a very close friend of mine, with whom I had some evidential telepathic experiences that we both observed and documented while he was still alive, passed. And some short time after that passing, began what appeared to be an after-death relationship. Now, I say appeared to be because I approach all paranormal phenomenon from the phenomenological stance, where you relate to the phenomenon on its own terms, but without trying to claim absolute certainty about mm-hmm. the level of reality, because the phenomenological idea, this really relates to philosopher Immanuel Kant, is that there's a phenomenon and then there's a noumena, what's actually there. And we never experience anything but phenomenon, including with our physical senses. When I'm looking around my room with my eyes, these are reflected light falling on the back of my retina upside down. There's also a big hole in the back of each retina where the optic nerve is, and my brain will just fill that in. So basically what I'm seeing with my physical eyes is a phenomenon. It's a past tense because it takes a significant fraction of a second for my brain to turn the image right side up. And, of course, it doesn't see all the wavelengths and so forth. So we never experience anything more than a phenomenon. So I don't make an absolute reality claim, even though there's evidence and continual paranormal experiences. But when paranormal experiences happen, this is kind of the dirty little secret of paranormal research, it's almost impossible to say what paranormal thing happened. So, for example, let's say my friend, who I'm using the pseudonym Alex for today, were to tell me, hey, since you keep doubting if I'm here, take out a coin. I want you to flip it 12 times in a row, and I predict it'll land tails every time. So let's say I try that.
Which is nearly impossible.
Right. It would be statistically so improbable that it would almost certainly indicate something paranormal going on. So let's say I conduct that experiment and I get 12 tails in a row. Now, does that prove my friend is really, really there? No, because other paranormal things could have happened. Maybe I telekinetically influenced mm-hmm. the coins. Maybe I had a short-term precognition, and paranormal research, this is called decision augmentation theory, where you know the precise moment in time to perform an experiment to get the desired results. So this is just a caution that I have, but there's also other possibilities. I realized early on, because when you know somebody really well, you have this deep holographic memory of them. If I asked you to have an imaginary conversation with your mom, you would be able to easily imagine things that she would say in response to various questions, and you wouldn't have her say things that would be out of character and so forth. So if somebody is deceased, there's always the possibility you could take that holographic memory and make them into a kind of, imaginary friend or something like that. That, however, could be a helpful thing because keeping that alive could actually invite the authentic person to come forward and increasingly inhabit that role. There are many different possibilities, and I described some of those in the document that's linked up on the website. But when the presence is actually happening, it's often so powerful that in those moments I can't participate with doubts, because the doubts are kind of a thinking function thing that goes on, and the mind can never really resolve these things. On the heart gnosis level, I know I'm relating to an authentic autonomous entity of some sort. Even if he were a subpersonality I've created based on a holographic memory, he would now appear to have a great deal of autonomy and independent feelings and perceptions and so forth, and therefore should be treated with great respect. And this is one of my fundamental principles of relating to any kind of entity on whatever level of reality, is that, you know, you should treat them with the universal ethics. You know, Martin Buber spoke about, you know, I-thou relationships and I-it relationships, in which you objectify people or treat them as objects. So whether you're relating to a fully physical person or, you know, even an imaginary friend, you would want to apply those same ethics. And, you know, even imaginary friends like that children have are, you know, people say, oh, well, they're not real. That's just an imaginary friend. Well, actually, that's not quite true, because they are, there's a factual actuality that they have that particular imaginary friend and not another. And so the contents of the psyche and what's going on in the imagination are factual actualities. So if right now I ask people in the audience to visualize a pink elephant, and some people do, well, it's a factual actuality that at that particular moment they visualized a pink elephant and not a red Buick. So
right.
Any complete history of the unfolding of the universe would have to include that. And if it had them imagining something else, that would be an error.
Jonathan, what does a parent do to a child when the child talks about their imaginary friend and the parent kind of puts them down, basically, and, you know, and tries to get them to acknowledge it doesn't happen, it doesn't exist?
Well, I don't make one-size formulas, because any type of relationship, it's, you know, just like if you say, are relationships good or bad? Well, obviously the answer is both, you know. So an imaginary relationship or a relationship with an entity could be healthy or unhealthy, depending on the particular case. But I would certainly not, if it were my child, immediately want to shut that down unless there was something about that particular relationship that seemed remarkably unhealthy, because it could serve a very healthy purpose to have such a relationship. And perhaps the so-called imaginary friend is actually a disincarnate spirit,
mm-hmm.
You know, something that we don't understand, but that really has full agency.
So you're saying it's okay to kind of convince them otherwise, that it doesn't happen?
Well, I think, no, I wouldn't do that personally, unless that relationship were like causing them to become dysfunctional and undermining their other relationships and things like that. Just as, you know, I wouldn't interfere with a child having a fully physical friend unless that friendship were raising red flags and were, you know, causing them to become unhealthy in some way.
Since you've been doing this, what has been for you one of the most compelling aspects to convince you that the afterlife exists, it's real?
Well, evidence of the existence of the afterlife, I mean, there are many extremely strong cases other than my own, you know, where there's all kinds of, you know, evident critical information given and stuff that could not be known by anybody but the deceased, unless we were to imagine, you know, unless we were to consider more fantastical paranormal explanations, like somebody accessing the Akashic record or something like that. In my case, probably the most convincing thing, even though there have been lots of, you know, remarkable paranormal things, is just the degree to which it adds vitality, and to which, even though I have all kinds of healthy other relationships, they don't take the place of this one. And you know, kind of like a test, my friend, who I'm calling Alex, who is upset that I hadn't done certain things that I promised to do, just withdrew his presence for about 3 hours a couple of months ago. It was just a remarkable drop in energy level for me. Even when, during that time, a very young, vibrant, high-energy friend of mine came over, it was no substitute for the energetic symbiosis of the presence of this not fully physical friend. So to me, that's very impressive, because a real test for things is healthiness, and that which makes you more viable as an organism and enhances your development. And so it's the enhancement of my life that overall is the most impressive thing for me, rather than any specific instance of evidence or paranormal phenomenon.
Aren't relationships, though, with entities that you can't see kind of strange or dangerous?
They can be extremely strange and dangerous, and I have a whole section of writings on my website about that. We've talked about it before. I refer to them generically as mind parasites and so forth, and I put links up to that on the page that's linked to your site, and that's a vast topic in itself. Today, I'm more interested in focusing on the positive side of these relationships, but absolutely, but there are certain distinctions to be made so that people can reality test whether particular entities are malign or benign. But no question, all cultures report both types of relationships with entities, and one should be very wary about any relationship, including with fully physical folks, that is draining their energy or is manipulative or interfering with their free will.
Well, with Jonathan Zapp, his website, zapporacle.com, linked up at coasttocoastam.com. We'll take calls with Jonathan next hour. You can share your afterlife communication stories as well. How come some people can't communicate with the other side and some others can?
Well, there may be many reasons for that. I mean, most people are very identified with their kind of physical, mundane life and what's going on. And also, we are, our perception is so predominated by our physical senses. So to be able to relate to entities that don't register on the back of our retinas and stuff like that, takes an ability to divide attention and to tune into more subtle energies. And I've learned a number of things that help with that, and I've listed some of that on that page. In my case, I think the fact that I spend a lot of time in writing sessions where my mind can go anywhere and where my imagination has become far more powerful than it was earlier in my life, and I'm open to sort of intuitions coming in and so forth, it makes me an ideal candidate. But I don't, walk down the street and, see dead people and stuff. I mean, this is mostly about one relationship. Mm-hmm. There's a very strong emotional bond and a telepathic bond while the person was still alive. So that made that possibility more probable, it would seem. People, when they've done scientific polls of Americans, a very high percentage will report having had a very vivid after-death communication from a deceased loved one, most often in the early days or weeks after their passing and so forth. But a lot of people don't know how to perpetuate that, and therefore they will tend to drift apart from that person. Many different things govern it, just like many different things govern why somebody will be a writer or a piano player or have good relationships with fully physical folks, or become a loner and not have good relationships and so forth.
John, what are tulpas?
Tulpas, I think it's translated as mind-made bodies, and this is an idea you find in a few spiritual traditions. In the Jewish tradition, there's talk about Dybbuks and golems, where a magician or some kind of occult practitioner will create an identity for a alternate person and do various things to make them seem more and more real until they feel they become real. Now, they're in legendary accounts, they may become fully physically real. I don't know that there's any strong evidence of that, but something that's highly related that fiction writers, and I'm also a fiction writer, experience is you start to create a literary character and they take on a life of their own. And many fiction writers have had the experience that they develop agency and will do unexpected things that might be quite inconvenient to where you wanted the arc of the story to go. Now, one way of explaining this is that we know as a scientific fact that a human psyche can split off and develop other alternate psyches. And this is, called multiple personality disorder. Now the label is dissociative identity disorder. But I put up some quotes from a Scientific American of 2018 where these alternate selves and somebody with this condition show up differently on, functional MRIs and stuff like that. So we also, those of us who don't have this very rare condition, are actually still a multiplicity of subpersonalities. And many people just aren't aware of that because all of those subpersonalities still call themselves I, but we are can be remarkably different. You know, the George Norrie that is on the air and the George Norrie that's in a business meeting and the George Norrie that, you experience when you're alone driving in your car may be quite different. And I'll notice this multiplicity of selves. Just say I'm walking down the street and I see, an ice cream shop, and I might hear sort of a childish voice inside of me say, "I want that." And then a kind of parental, critical voice will say, "Well, you know you're not supposed to have that." And then another voice will say, "Ah, just go for it." And then another voice will say, "Well, I really shouldn't, but starting tomorrow I won't, but this time I will." And so most people just don't notice the psychological reality that we have many different subpersonalities. Unlike people with multiple personality disorder, they have a classic symptom where there are memory gates, where when one takes over, others may not be aware of what's going on. But there is usually one alter that's kind of a witness personality that's watching the whole process. So I think that this is a normal function of the human psyche.
Jonathan, you don't talk much about demonic forces. How come?
Well, I do. These are all my writings, a whole category of my website called Mind Parasites, and it talks about, and I've had experiences myself, of negative entities, mm-hmm. which are quite abundant, and they're reported in all cultures. A kind of rarer subject is beneficial relationships with other entities, so that's why I'm emphasizing that now. But I don't want to give short shrift to that subject. I could speak forever about the other topic, but I already have many other writings, and we've even done shows on that subject as well. But it's definitely a high danger not to be discounted. And one of the documents is called The Siren Call of Hungry Ghosts. It's based on the British paranormal researcher Joe Fisher's story, where he decided to investigate channeling and found remarkable entities that had all kinds of paranormal knowledge about him and his life and so forth, and it seemed to speak these high spiritual principles and so forth. But as he got kind of sucked into their orbit and did further research, he found that they were not who they claimed to be in earlier lives.
Tricksters, no doubt. We're going to come back and talk more with you, Jonathan, and take calls next.